were in your third or fourth prison. What was the worst experience you had during this time?
I think the worst experience was a place called Dog Patch. And this was, if you recall, I went to the Hilton initially and then moved over to a place we called the Swimming Pool, which was sort of a makeshift camp, prisoner of war camp. And then they moved us out to this place called Dog Patch. And Dog Patch was, I don't know where exactly it was, I never found out, but it was certainly outside of Hanoi. And it consisted of four cell huts made of stone. And they had real rough stucco on the inside. I mean, big knobs of cement sticking out of the wall, so you couldn't lean against it very comfortably. There were two beds in each cell. The food was terrible, very little of it, to the point where most of us suffered from a disease called beriberi. I don't know the medical aspects of the disease, but it's some kind of deficiency in nutrients. Beriberi causes your peripheral nervous system to start to die. It manifests itself with me in both feet, started to ache like I had run on a stone and gotten a stone bruise, just a dull ache. And then the pain started spreading up to both legs and a little bit to each hand. And it was the peripheral nervous system dying. Other people experienced their vision going. Parts of the retina would die. There was no relief other than I would exercise very heavily until I was exhausted and then lie down and I could sleep for a couple of hours. And then I'd wake up and do the same thing. And that went on for months and months and months until finally the Vietnamese decided to change the diet and it eventually went away.
What were they feeding you?
It was basically a bowl of rice and a bowl of soup. We called it sewer weed soup. It looked like grass cuttings or something that they had cut off on an irrigation ditch and boiled it. And you got that twice a day. So, and that was the extent of your nutrition, and it wasn't enough because a lot of people suffered from beriberi.
And what did you do to exercise?
You could do deep knee bends. You could do jumping jacks. You could do push-ups, leg lifts. You could do exercise, and I did the exercise under those conditions so that I could get tired enough that I could sleep, because otherwise I couldn't sleep.
Were you able to know what was going on in the States?
I think when I first got out there, if I recall, there were no speakers in the cell. And then shortly after we got there, they installed speakers in the cell. And then we would listen to the Voice of Vietnam.
Which was?
That, I think, is what we called Hanoi Hannah. It was propaganda, pure and simple, but it was an event. So anything to break the monotony of your existence. I think I was there for about 6 months and then got my first roommate. So I had somebody to talk to during the day, and that was magical as far as morale goes, because you didn't have to go through any kind of machinations to communicate with your roommate. You could just talk. I was moved out of that room and then into another cell with a different person. So it was a whole new set of things to talk about in conversation.
And here in the States, they had no idea that you were a prisoner. Is that correct?
Yeah, my family did not know I was a prisoner. This is talking to them afterwards. They were immediately notified that I was missing in action. And then there was no further information until I think they got their first bit of information in 1968.
1968 was the year of the Tet Offensive, a strategic military strike by the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong on hundreds of cities, towns, and military bases across the country. Although its immediate gains were few, the attack shook American confidence in the war. CBS's Walter Cronkite had gone to Vietnam to see the situation for himself. When he returned, he offered a blunt assessment to viewers. As the popular and disputed story goes, President Johnson watched Cronkite's broadcast and remarked, "If I've lost Cronkite, I've lost the country." Indeed, support for the war was about to turn on Johnson.
So, you're gone from Dogpatch. What's next?
Next, we went back to Wallow Prison and into a four-man cell. Went from one roommate to three roommates. That was a pretty big deal because now you could have unending conversations because there was four brains there all trying to
stay alive.
Yes, and say something.
All right, so what were those moments like? You're back at the Hilton, and for how long was your tenure there?
It was like 7 or 8 months, I think. Those time recollections are a little vague, but about that. I was blessed by being roommates with two Marines who happened to be the pilot and his radar intercept officer. So the two Marines knew each other extremely well. They flew together. And then an Air Force pilot about my age. And we spent a good amount of time just catching up on our own personal experiences as prisoners. And then that, of course, branched out to trying to find out as much information about the other person as you could and so forth. And then we reached sort of a point where we got bored, at least during parts of the day. So the Marine pilot, who was a major, so he was the senior guy in our room, decided that what we needed was some competition. So we started a mosquito killing competition. Every afternoon, about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, we would have a 30-minute mosquito killing competition to see who could kill the most mosquitoes that day. And then somebody said, I think, "Do you know Spanish?" The idea was, well, if somebody knows Spanish, we can learn a foreign language. So I had had Spanish in high school and also at the Naval Academy. I was not fluent. I was not conversant. But I had some recollection of words and grammar and so forth. We had no paper and pencil, so it was just I would give out like 5 words of vocabulary each day. We could keep going over it and over and over it, and they'd try to memorize that. Then we'd put together simple sentences and then try to expand it to the limit of my knowledge. And the amazing thing for me was that as I began, I didn't think I knew anything about Spanish. And then as I was asked questions, these words started popping up from my subconscious somewhere from the memory bank. And I had a much bigger vocabulary than I thought I had.
So you spent those months teaching your three roommates, so to speak, Spanish.
Yeah.
During this period in the war, Admiral James Stockdale, who was shot down at around the same time as Commander Moore, assumed the role of commander of the POWs incarcerated with him. Jeremiah Denton, in a famous so-called propaganda broadcast, used Morse code by blinking that he had been tortured to do the broadcast. and John McCain was in the Hanoi Hilton, recovering from injuries that occurred while ejecting from his plane.
In your routine, you were pushed to show deference to your captors.
The Vietnamese expected us, as their prisoners, to show deference to them by bowing. And our upbringing, our culture, our nature resists doing that. So there was a lot of petty conflict between the POWs and the Vietnamese over the bowing issue.
So if you didn't bow, what happened?
But they would whack you with a rifle butt or something.
So you learn to bow.
Well, what's your choice?
What's your choice is right. I mean, I understand.
You know, you're between a rock and a hard spot, right. And there's not too much that you can do.
Were you ever able to get mail?
Correct me if I'm wrong. I believe Ho Chi Minh died in September of 1969. 2 months later, things changed as far as our treatment went. They improved in some curious ways anyway. The first thing we got was a tea cozy. I think it's what it's called. It's a basket that's lined with some stuffing, and then you put your teapot in there and it keeps it warm. Each of us got one of those things. And we could not figure out what the heck we were supposed to do with them because they didn't really serve us tea. They served us hot water that they had boiled to kill the parasites, but there was no tea in it. But that's what they told us. Oh, it's to keep your water hot all day. And then the second thing, they went from 2 cigarettes a day to 6 cigarettes a day, which was, for somebody who smokes, that was like, you know, manna from heaven. The food didn't really improve that much. I think it was sometime in late 69, they informed us that we could write a letter home and then gave us the criteria, you know, the terms and conditions, what you could say and what you couldn't say. And they brought us out to a table, sat us down, gave us the sort of form of the letter. It was a certain size and so forth. We filled it in and wrote our letter, and it got mailed back to the States. And so that was the first letter to our relatives back home. And then later on, we started getting a letter or two from our families.
So the first inkling that your family had that you were still alive.
Real concrete evidence, yeah.
Real concrete evidence was all of a sudden a letter shows up with the mailman.
Right. Now, those letters got processed through some government bureaucracies before they got home, because some of the letters, initially not mine, but some of the letters had information besides what was plainly visible on the letter.
In code?
Yes.
In code as to what was happening in the prison?
Yes. Basic information like who's here? That was probably the main bit of information that we were trying to get out, was a list of everybody that we knew of that was in the POW system in North Vietnam.
Stockdale talks about keeping in his mind the list of names.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty much what we all did. We all kept 200 or 300 names in our head, or tried to.
How did you devise a code for the letters that went outside the prison?
Well, there were a few people selected pretty much at random. As they went through training, who were given special training on how to encode messages within plain text if you were captured or shot down. So it just so happened that there were some guys who had received that specialized training before they came over to Vietnam and could encode messages within plain text. And then that letter would get decoded and then sent on to the family.
It's 1970. You've been in prison 5 years.
Yeah.
Where are you?
1970, let's see. I was at a place called Son Tay, which is the name of town that's I don't know, 50, 60 kilometers west of Hanoi. And it was a compound. There were two buildings in the compound. And then outside the compound were some barracks for the troops. There were guard towers at each corner of the wall. And there was a bathhouse right in the middle. And there was 15 cells maybe, but big. Some of them held 6-8 people. And that's where I was up until July of 1970.
In the town you were in, there was an attempt to free prisoners. Let's talk about that.
One day, a mysterious airplane flew over that we couldn't recognize, because prior to that, we had been out there when MiG aircraft, Vietnamese aircraft, had flown over, and I guess we were near an airfield in their traffic pattern. But this airplane we couldn't recognize. It later turned out it was a drone that the United States had sent over to take pictures of this, what they thought was a prisoner of war camp. And they used those photos to analyze whether or not there were Americans there by noting, you know, tiny little details that air intelligence people can sometimes figure out. We found that later, and that was the basis for the raid that took place in, I would say, it must have been early November of 1970. They used that data from the drone to help convince them that there were American POWs there. The raid was in early November of 1970. We were moved out of Santé in July of 1970 and moved to what you would call a Luxo POW camp. It was barracks that had been converted into large sort of open cells. The windows were open. You could get fresh air through. There was plenty of space around the bunks. We were let out during the daytime to just putter around. Plenty of water for bathing every day. Food much improved over what it had been in Santé. And there were about 230 people in this show camp. We found out later that it had been designed especially as a show camp so that the International Red Cross could come in and see the facilities, how well we were being treated, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
The Germans did that with Theresienstadt.
Yes.
Same kind of scene.
Everything is all rosy and hunky-dory here.
The raid itself took place, but failed.
It didn't actually fail, because we got to meet, after we got back, we got to meet all the participants in that raid and talk to them. And they said that their best intelligence was that there were Americans at the camp in Santé, but it wasn't a certainty. It was based on sort of old data. And therefore, they made the decision, even if there's only a small chance, we're willing to take that chance to get these people out. They described the raid itself as being very successful because it went exactly according to plan. They landed a helicopter in the middle of that courtyard that I was describing, where we were standing outside looking up, deliberately crashed it, and then got out and started shooting at the guard towers. And then another helicopter landed outside the courtyard and went in and I guess killed all of the people who were in the barracks, and then went on a room-to-room search. And of course, nobody was in the rooms. So they packed everything up and got out of there. And I think the only injury was a broken leg or a sprained leg or something like that. But no Americans lost their lives in the effort.
Did you have any inkling that something was going to happen?
Not a clue. Not a clue. What we did experience on the night of the raid, we were in this camp about 20 miles away at the show camp. It was about 20 or 30 miles away from Santé, apparently. We started hearing anti-aircraft artillery, and we could see explosions in the sky from time to time where the shells would explode, and a lot of noise. And then it died down, because they had finished the raid and they all headed back to their base in Thailand, I think. So there was activity, and there had been a long period of time when there had been no activities, no airplanes flying over, no distant bombing sounds or anything like that. So we just sort of scratched our heads. And then 2 or 3 days later, the trucks arrived at the show camp, and we were told to roll up our gear and get on the trucks. And then off we went to Hanoi, and it was a reaction to the raid on Son Tay. They thought that this show camp would be the next target, and so they moved all the POWs back into Hanoi to keep the U.S. from rescuing us.
You're moved out of the show camp. Where are you moved to?
We're moved back to Wallo Prison, and for the first time, we're put in a very large room designed to hold 40 or 50 people. But it was the first time that I had ever been in a group that large. I mean, it was almost like carnival atmosphere. There were so many people there. And a lot of them I had never met before. I probably knew their names, but never talked to them or tapped through the wall to them. It was like a sort of a big reunion in a way. Then we started to discover, with all these people in the room, there were a lot of things that we could do to entertain ourselves. So this is in late 1970, and we've got 40 people, 40 different minds, 40 different educational backgrounds, 40 kinds of knowledge stored away in our heads, and so forth and so on. And that's when we began thinking about organizing our day with activities. And so one of the activities was foreign languages, and we had 4 people who could teach 4 different languages. So we had Spanish, French, Russian, and German.
Being taught by fellow inmates.
Correct.
And so that was similar to your teaching Spanish at an earlier time.
That's correct, yes.
What happened with classes? There was no chalk, there was no paper. How did you do it?
We did it by word of mouth, people listening and then repeating and listening and repeating.
Were there other exciting things going on at the time? Other teachings?
We tried teaching math, but math probably requires a paper and pencil to really learn math. It's hard to do it just in your head. It didn't succeed very well. We also formed up a choir, and we had non-denominational religious services on Sunday, I think. The Vietnamese at first objected and then relented and said, well, it's okay. So we formed up a choir of sorts to sing pretty bland religious music. Then we decided that if we could do that, maybe we could do South Pacific. So this is in our room. 10 or 15 people got together and said, I can remember the lyrics from There Is Nothing Like a Dame, for example. And I can remember.
You've got to be carefully taught.
Right. And Some Enchanted Evening, You May See a Stranger. And we sort of pieced it together, but we didn't have all the parts. And then we practiced singing the musical parts. We had nothing to make costumes out of, so we just kissed off the idea of costumes. But we finally put together enough of bits and pieces of the lyrics and the music to be able to sort of sing through South Pacific. We didn't have the dialogue. Mitzi Gaynor wasn't mushing that man out of her hair or anything, but it was just something to do.
And was just for the 40 of you?
Yes.
Or for everyone else in prison?
No. I mean, I think there were some other cells that could hear us, maybe, when we sang it. The Vietnamese seemed sort of amused by it. A lot of the guards came to the door of the cell and just stood and watched and probably giggled. It was this constant battle with boredom that I think everybody who's in prison probably fights that battle every day.
And you were sharing books in an interesting way.
Well, this was more entertainment than education. And again, in the evening, we did not have anything to entertain us. So we decided that maybe somebody try to tell a book that they had read. And the book that I told was Great Expectations. I didn't remember it all exactly, but I remembered a lot. And then other people would help me out sometimes filling in the cracks. Another guy told a series of stories by Horatio Hornblower that were absolutely fascinating, just as riveting as a radio broadcast, probably, at least under the conditions we were in. Movies were told. There were even times prior to that, when we weren't getting fed very well, where we would tell about our favorite restaurant. And one guy told a story about his visit to a restaurant in Paris called the Tour d'Argent, Tower of Silver. And it's apparently a world-famous restaurant, Michelin 3-star restaurant. And he told it in excruciating detail, exactly what he had and so forth and so on. And sure enough, I stuck that in my head and promised myself, if I ever get out of here, I'm going to the Tour d'Argent.
Young girls pick them